So let's move on to item eight, which is our presentation from Emerald Investment Advisors. Tim, did you want to do the lead in for this, or do we want to jump right into Emerald?
I think we can go ahead and bring the Emerald folks on as presenters, and I will turn this over to the team. We have Ken Mertz, Stacy Sears, and Joe Garner all joining us, I believe, today.
Right. I show all three are going to be joining us as well.
Great.
Don't know if they've moved over yet.
And Mitch, if you could stop sharing your screen, we'll have them run their slides.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Thank you, Tim. That also improves my gallery view. Or maybe not.
This is Ken. Can you hear me?
Ken, we can hear you. Yes. Good morning.
Good morning to you. It's afternoon here, and we're really pleased to be here.
Well, good afternoon. I see Stacy has joined us as well, and I see Joe. So all three of you are with us. Good morning. Good afternoon. Pardon me. Wherever you may be.
To you as well.
Thanks.
So
the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and appreciate the investment review. We found that very interesting. Agree with a lot of Tim's and Mitch's remarks, and I think we'll add one or two things to that part of the world for you. On page two of our presentation, if Joe can share that with you. There we go. Just briefly overview. You mentioned we are just celebrated our 18-year anniversary with you. We really appreciate that. That is not the norm in the industry, and we're very proud of that fact. Our average on this page, you'll see that our average client tenure is 14 years. So our relationship with Contra Costa County has been moving that average upwards. We're about at $6 billion in assets, or most of that is where we started in the small cap growth way back in the early 90s. And that remains the predominant part of our assets on the management, the small cap growth product. We have six large accounts. You're part of that six large relationships for us. And so that's, a very important aspect, again, of our relationship. If we could just take that over to the Emerald Advantage page, just a little bit of review on how we go about doing what we do. We're a fundamental bottom-up manager. We're very proud to be an active manager. We believe that the world has gone passive to over 50% of the assets now being managed passive. We think in the future that will open up more inefficiencies in the marketplace. And that is one of the things that our process of using our own skill set as research analysts and portfolio managers are trying to exploit every day, the inefficiencies in the marketplace. We have collective experience on the portfolio management team, 94 years. All three of us have been with the firm at least since 1994. We have 13 analysts with 17 years of average tenure with the firm. Philosophy, as I said, is active management. Uncover opportunities in what we believe is the least efficient part of the marketplace, that is in small cap growth. And the reason for that is not as many eyeballs are on the names that we look at. Plus, a lot of these companies are breaking new grounds. It's an entrepreneurial environment, but it also is a disruptive environment of new ideas coming to the marketplace and trying to disrupt the older, more mature companies and philosophies in the marketplace. Our process is a 10-step research process that's been in place for our entire duration of a firm. Joe's going to go over that quickly with you. One of the things that we pride ourselves on is that last bullet point on the under the process is the pre-profit area, which continues to grow. And again, is a feature of small cap growth. We don't shy away from that. We embrace those names. And we think we have demonstrated the skill set to invest in the opportunity set when the time is right. That doesn't mean we're always there, but it means that we use our skill set to be there when the risk reward is in our favor. The pre-profit area can be broken down into new technologies, new consumer discretionary models, or new aspects coming through that aspect, as well as the biggest area, which is biotech and new drugs being formulated, going through the FDA process, and coming today to provide cures. We concentrate in the oncology space, as well as the orphan drug space. And the aspect there is that there isn't as many patients that are part of this space of the biotech, where the small cap biotechs focus, so that the Pfizers, Mercks, Bristol Myers are not looking at the orphan drug universe like the small cap companies are. There's a persistence in our style. There's a persistence in our manner of getting to the work, and there's persistence in our track record. And then lastly, one of the things that is important, we have a philosophy of portfolio management, which can work in up markets as well as in down markets. We don't have a institutional bias on either side. We can't always outperform. But we have demonstrated that we can be in the upper left-hand quadrant, which means that over the majority of quarters and years that we have performed on both sides of the marketplace. Let me turn it over to Joe, and he can run through what we still believe is an inefficient universe on page 6. And then our team and our investment process quickly for you.
Thank you, Ken, and thank you, all of you, for your time today. I want to reinforce one of the points that Ken had mentioned, and that's the inefficiency inherent in the small cap portion of the market, why we think it makes the small cap area particularly interesting. So this chart is our proof. So if you use sell-side analyst coverage, this is the number of analysts at the Wall Street brokerage firms that cover an individual stock. And we look at the S&P 500 to measure the large cap portion of the market and the Russell 2000 to measure the small cap portion of the market. On average, there are nearly 19 analysts covering the typical S&P 500 stock. There are only 5 to 6 covering the typical Russell 2000 stock. And if you think of this in terms of a normal distribution curve, and look at the side of the curve that we would consider to be heavily covered. Lots of analysts, stocks that are widely followed, and we define that as 20 or more analysts covering. That's 40% of the large cap market and less than 1% of the small cap market. Now think of the other end of the spectrum, which is where there's very little analyst coverage, which we define as 5 or fewer. There's less than 3% of the S&P 500 stocks that fall into that category and nearly 60% of the small caps. And then if you go out one step even further, where there are 2 or fewer analysts, there's one stock in the S&P 500 that falls into that category and 20% of the Russell 2000. So while we look throughout the Russell 2000, not just at the 5 or fewer and 2 or fewer, there is ample opportunity to find companies that may be very high quality, very promising, high growth companies that for whatever reason are not getting much attention for Wall Street. And through our bottom-up, fundamentally driven, intensive research process can identify those opportunities and take advantage of them. We do that with our team, as Ken referenced earlier. We have 13 investment professionals. We have a high degree of a very long tenure with our team, average of 17 years. And among the three portfolio managers, I've been with Emerald since 1994, and I'm the new guy on the team. So that will give you a flavor for the tenure within the organization. We think we have a great culture, and we think we have a process that it enables the analysts to go out and be on the forefront of a lot of exciting and sometimes revolutionary changes in the markets and the economy. And one thing we point out here is while we have some very broad people to identify some of these unique niche type small cap growth opportunities, there are areas where you need significant industry and scientific expertise. And we've gone out and gotten that where we felt we needed. And I would look at the bottom row for that. Nishit Trivedi and Terry Smith are PhDs and MBAs from Penn State University who make up our healthcare team, our life sciences team. And we believe it's that intersection of that scientific expertise and the financial skill sets where you will have the most consistent and long-term success in what can be a very challenging area. The other individual that I point out there is Dr. Nathan Jones, also from that same program, who is on our tech team. And the reason we pointed him there is that he's covering more of the science-heavy portions of the tech universe. Think semiconductors, think networking communication technologies, things like that. Again, bringing that science and financial skill sets. Jerry, I see that you have a question. We can certainly pause here for that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This may have been covered before, but I don't see our chairman in the picture, so he may not be on the camera right now. If it was covered before, then please forgive me. But you have a footnote down at the bottom of each one of your pages that this is a presentation intended for Cicero only. You do acknowledge and realize that this is a public meeting.
Yes,
very good. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Yes. And then to move along, the core of what we do, and Ken referenced it earlier, is our 10-step research process. This is how we address that inefficiency. We go out, we roll up our sleeves, and we do our homework. So just to touch on some of the high points here, you know, we'll start by doing the background and looking at the SEC filings, the news stories, the press release to understand what's going on. But we find with a lot of our small companies, they're not going to be in the typical places of the Wall Street Journal or on CNBC or in Barron's. Unless they've done something wrong, then they tend to be front and center. So we've got to really work hard to dig into the local press, the industry press, and the social media to find out what's going on. And we also have a very active intern program to help us. And they're often much more familiar with the digital media and the next generation sources of media that help us along with that. Where I think we add the most value for you are steps 2 through 6 of the process. Number 2, meeting with management teams. We believe in small companies in particular, there's no substitute for going out in the field, meeting the people that run the businesses face-to-face, understanding where they're strong, where they're weak, where they're investing, and where they see the opportunities. In a normal non-COVID environment, we're going out and doing those 2,000 plus meetings every year, many of those on site at the company headquarters, in their manufacturing facilities, distribution centers, retail outlets, et cetera. In the COVID environment, we've actually done more meetings, but they tend to be like this. In a face-to-face environment over a video communications platform. We resumed users long before the pandemic, so it was natural to us. We no longer have the friction of having to get on an airplane or a train or driving on a turnpike to go from one company to the next. We've actually been able to cover a little more ground. And as the economy's been reopening, we've actually been able to get out into the field and have been able to do some of those plant tours and face-to-face meetings and trade show meetings again. But we will not just take a company's word for it. So we go out and talk to customers to understand why they bought a product or service. We talk to competitors to see the other side of the story. We talk to suppliers to see if there are any issues in the supply chain, and no time more important than now with all the supply chain issues that you all hear about in the daily news and how that can impact businesses. And we talk to distributors to see what sell-through looks like across a channel. When we've done all that, we break out our spreadsheets. We develop our own financial models and our own valuation models. We're not relying on what numbers others may be publishing out there. And we often find if we do our work well enough, we're identifying financial opportunities that others might not have yet caught on to. one of the later things we do is look at that research that might be available to see where the differences are along the way. We put together internal research reports. We have reports that we commonly share with Tim and Mitch as samples of what's in the portfolio. Those reports summarize all the research that went into a particular holding in the portfolio, an assessment of the competitive advantages, the management team, the growth drivers, the risk factors, and the investment thesis. So we know why we own what we own, and we use that as a roadmap throughout the holding period. When those growth drivers are getting better, the risk factors are declining, when the competitive advantages are getting stronger, that's when we're buying more. And when the opposite's happening, that's when we're selling and exiting. And communications throughout the process, critically important. When you've got all these analysts in the field doing all these meetings, to get that information back to where it needs to be. And those are informal meetings. Those are in research notes. They generate over 1,000 research notes a year. A lot of information flowing back and forth. One very quick example that I can give you of a real world how this works is with a long-term holding in our portfolio, the Trex company. And Trex is the leader in composite decking and railing materials, which are used as an alternative to wood. So if you have a deck on the back of your home, think of those deck boards. Deck boards are typically wood, but in their case, they're made from recycled plastics and recycled wood particles. Over 95% of the material used in those boards is recycled. So it definitely has an environmentally friendly aspect to it, but it also has a performance advantage. So if you have a wood deck at home, and I've owned one in the past myself, you'll know that it looks great for those first several months. But before you get too long down the road, you're starting to run into issues where you're going to need to continue to seal it. It's going to dry. It's going to fade. It's going to start splintering. You might start to see some warping of the boards. You avoid a lot of that with the Trex product, where it maintains its color. If you get a stain on it, wash it with a garden hose. There's none of that backbreaking work every year or 2 years on the deck. And so by year two, you typically are ahead of the game, even though the Trex board will cost a little bit more at retail. That market back in 2012, when we first invested in Trex, composites were 15% of the decking industry. Today, they've grown to be roughly 25% of the industry. Trex had half the market then, have even more than that today. So during that holding period, the process that went into it, we visited their primary manufacturing facility in Winchester, Virginia. I would say we're at double-digit plus visits at that facility. In fact, the last time we visited their seat, which was a few months ago, their CEO had commented that no investors have been through the plant more than we have. We do an annual survey of over 200 Home Depot, Lowe's, and professional lumber yards throughout the country. We're talking to them on the phone to understand how the deck building season's going. What's new? What new products are out there? What feedback they're getting from consumers? Who's running special promotions? These tend to be special order products. So how long is it going to take me to get a product? Things like that. And that's helped us over time because it's called attention to things like Trex's share gains in specific geographic markets across the country as they've continued to build on their leadership position. It's identified times when they've run in and their competitors have run into production issues causing those wait times to increase significantly. It's also highlighted times when the retailers have commented that demand is so strong that the manufacturers are having difficulty keeping up, which is the situation the market finds itself in today. After we took all that information together, built our models, it identified to us a much higher level of revenue and earnings growth possibility than what we saw evident in Wall Street estimates, leading many of those Wall Street analysts to say that the stock looked awfully expensive to them. Many of them still have that opinion today and have had it the entire 9+ years that we've held the stock. Well, during that 9+ year period of time, Trex has grown from $300 million in revenues to $1.1 billion today. Their profitability, their net income has grown from $26 million to nearly $250 million. And their share price has increased from $4 a share to over $105 a share. So we would have disagreed strongly, as we did throughout our holding period, that those who thought it looked expensive weren't seeing the entire opportunity. This is the type of process that we put into each of our holdings. whether it's going out and doing retail surveys like that, consumer packaged good type companies and other consumer facing businesses, surveying IT resellers and consultants for cybersecurity products and other software offerings, or talking to physicians and other healthcare professionals about new drugs and medical devices that are coming to the marketplace. With that, let me hand it over to Stacy Sears, who will just give you a quick refresher on how we put this all together into a portfolio.
Sure. Joe, could you move to page 10? There we go. So all of that, all of those inputs that we're receiving on a weekly and daily basis from our research team as they're going through that process, I think importantly, one of the things that I should point out is that, you know, the analysts aren't presenting us, you know, the feedback from those channel checks, you know, when they get to step 10 and the communication of the internal report. It really is a very much an interactive process. The portfolio managers really are involved from kind of step one in working with the analysts to vet these names. They are communicating to us again as they go through that process. We have the opportunity through each step to voice concerns and or questions. So as we get to step 10, you know, 9 out of 10 times, that's the portfolio managers are involved and engaged and on board with adding that name to the portfolio. So how that works out from a portfolio construction process, the Emerald portfolios typically run 110 to 120 stocks. I think importantly, this is not diversification for diversification's sake. We truly believe that this is the portfolio of the best small cap companies within the small cap universe. The reason for the diversification is really that each individual stock has its own risk reward characteristics. So we structure the portfolio in an unequal weighted positioning, and that we will take position sizes anywhere from 0.5% to 2% to start. Maximum position size is 5%, so we'll hold no more than 5% of any one stock within the portfolio. And typically, I will tell you that, you know, we're paring that back when we're getting to that 3-3.5% range. It's rarely a situation where you will see a stock at 5%. And the position sizes, I think importantly, you know, we have a tendency to inch in and inch out. So we will start, you know, towards that 0.5% position and then scale up. A lot of that scaling will be contingent upon the company's really ability to execute on the goals that we had laid out internally through that internal research report. And the consideration matrix, you know, that goes around that positioning is really core to why we're running an unequal weighted portfolio. So if you think about the small capitalization universe, we have companies that run the spectrum of where they are from a business development perspective, where they are from an earnings maturity perspective. Certainly the risk profile of a pre-profit biotechnology company that's in phase two, attempting to bring a new therapeutic to market to treat a novel disease state, and is in a cash is a cash user versus a generator, you know, is very different than a consumer staples company with a proven market dynamic, a strong earnings profile, good earnings linearity, and a strong balance sheet. So what we use that unequal weighted positioning for is to give us the ability to participate across the risk spectrum within the small capitalization universe and construct a portfolio that we think puts together best risk adjusted growth profile. So from a constraint perspective, just a couple things we'll just touch on there. We'll be no more than 3 times the Russell 2000 weight in any one sector with a max of 45%. And then we will be no more than 25% in any one industry, no more than 5% in any one stock from a position size. And I think also importantly, from a liquidity perspective, if you think about the small capitalization universe, we will own no more than the 5% ownership across firm-wide in the company. A lot of our peers, as they scaled assets, you'll see them, you know, own 10% of the outstanding shares of the company. We don't think that that's appropriately risk averse. You get married to that business. So as we have thought about capacity and portfolio structure, we've been committed to not owning more than 5% of any outstanding. of the outstanding shares of any company.
Okay, let me pick up on the performance page and just add one more aspect of what Stacy was covering. One of the things that we pride ourselves on is being able to invest in the smallest end of the Russell 2000. That would be companies under $1 billion in size, about 18 companies, and over 20% of the portfolio is invested in that smaller end of the universe. Just as a comparable, the index, we're a little bit above the index in what Morningstar would classify as microcap stocks. And they're looking at the whole universe of stocks, and they split it down between giant, large, mid, small, and micro. And that micro is about the same number that I gave you, about the billion size. We're about 2% greater than the index, but we're over 22% greater than our peer group. So if you were to look at, again, the numbers that Joe went through in terms of size matters with how many analysts are covering a name, size matters with how few analysts are covering the small end of the Russell. And again, on that emphasis that we have as a firm on capturing the inefficiency in the marketplace, it would be obviously across the whole small cap, but with maintaining our ability to always be invested in that less than $1 billion size. So we believe in any aspect of the marketplace to move where the opportunities are. And we've always been able to find those opportunities in the smallest end. Our performance we have on through June 30th, we just about met the benchmark for the second quarter. We lagged in the first quarter. We updated that through September 9th, and today's numbers are just about the same as that. We've been able to gain about 4% on the benchmark on a quarter to date for the third quarter. And we're above the benchmark by about 188 basis points for your portfolio year to date. So we've been able to claw back what we were behind. The market capture on page 14 is what I talked about earlier, an upside capture as well as downside capture. So we don't lose as much on the downside over our lifetime, and we still are able to outperform on the upside. And so this chart captures that from the inception of our firm. And then the batting average is looking at how many quarters that we can outperform, whether up quarters or down quarters, and we're above that 50% line for you. So I think that, again, is a differentiator. In terms of the marketplace that we've been facing, we have been facing a lot of macro-oriented marketplace. And I think that was part of your conversation earlier before we got on, looking at a marketplace that's been dominated by flows really since the COVID recovery period started. And a lot of people are still very much discussing that this is a flow marketplace. A lot of that early on flowed into the FANG stocks, and the S&P were dominated by what was happening in the four or five larger stocks in the universe that were obviously well positioned on that COVID recovery. We've also seen the mean aspects going on. And as Mitch talked about, the lesser quality names getting a whole lot of flows from the retail community. And we have a little bit on that, which I'll let Stacy cover. There's been a lot of gyrations around the yields, especially this year when we dropped from 170 basis points, 1.7%. On the 10-year, down under 120. caused a growth scare in the marketplace, a growth scare in small caps, especially in the growth small caps. We've had a more than a 5% decline in small cap growth since February. Everybody was talking about we were overextended as a market, which is obviously true. Monday's correction was, sharp and steeply down. Every aspect of the marketplace got hit. But the small cap growth area has already been hit and hit quite substantially. Just to give you a little bit of statistics, which I didn't include in this presentation, but large cap growth companies through yesterday were up 16%. Large cap value companies were up 14% on a year-to-date basis. Small cap value companies were up 18.7%. Part of that is the cyclical recovery. But small cap growth stocks have only been up 2.8%. It's not too often that we can declare a small cap growth manager to take a contrarian viewpoint, as small cap growth has been a very good place to be, historically. But clearly, with that kind of underperformance, there should be a reversion to the mean. The opportunity set is substantial, and we'll show you the earnings growth, which is substantially higher today for small caps versus the S&P companies. And the highest, I think, it's been since before the great financial crisis back in 2007 and 2008. So we're seeing substantial earnings growth not only occurring today in these stocks, but is forecasted forward by our own internal forecast as well as the streets. And so there's a big difference in terms of the recognition of those earnings, in terms of the performance of the marketplace, and those earnings, again, being considerably above the rest of the marketplace. So that's one of the reasons why we think small cap today is looking the most attractive, again, going back to the mid-2000s. Let me turn it over to Stacy for a couple of notes on the second quarter, and then we'll get into our characteristics and lay out our outlook for you.
Thank you, Ken. Joe, if you could move to page 19, I think I just would like to highlight two things for you to just put some perspective around the things that we've talked about today and that you all talked about in your review. I think an area of opportunity, as Ken mentioned, still remains within the small cap growth stocks. They have broadly lagged on a year-to-date basis. And from Emerald's perspective, historically, when you've seen value outperform growth and growth stocks not being appreciated in the marketplace, it's been a more challenging backdrop for a pure growth manager like Emerald. The rationale for why we've seen, I think, underperformance to growth was a lot of things that you all talked about, again, in the preview to this meeting. The V-shaped economic recovery came on much faster and was much broader than most had anticipated, which really led to a broadening of earnings growth. And when that happens, those faster growing companies become underappreciated relative to the rest of the universe when growth becomes so broad-based. And I think you can see that on this chart on page 19. Just quickly, a couple things to highlight. The top quintile, which is the fastest growing, which would be the fastest growing companies as measured by sales growth, that's on a forward year out. That is about 30 to 40% is what that growth rate would look like, just to put some perspective around it. That's where Emerald fits from a characteristic perspective. If you take a look at that performance on a year-to-date basis, so you're in the sixth column on the year-to-date, so the second chart, you can see that that top quintile has underperformed by 430 basis points, whereas the slowest growing companies have really seen, you know, that kind of Q3 and Q4 is where the bulk of that outperformance has gone. So the market has definitely been leaning in to the more value or GARP area, even within the Russell 2000 growth benchmark, as that value factor influence permeates not just, you know, the Russell 2000 value index, but the Russell 2000 index overall. On page 20, you can see this play out within earnings growth, the earnings growth rate. So again, from Emerald's perspective, our objective is to invest in the fastest growing companies within the sectors and industries that we invest in. The way that manifests itself from portfolio construction is a long-term earnings growth rate that outpaces the benchmark typically by anywhere from, you know, 150 to 300 basis points on an annualized basis. You know, where the portfolio structure has sat over the better part of the last 12 months has been with a growth rate that's been north of 20%. As you can see from this chart, if you just look at the year-to-date performance of the companies that are growing earnings faster than 20%, they're up about 5.8% versus the companies that are growing less than 10% that have gained over 19% for the year. So there definitely has been a value orientation. Whenever we see that in the marketplace, it is a headwind from a portfolio structure perspective. That being said, as Ken mentioned, we do see a lot of positive things on the horizon. Earnings growth has been tremendously favorable. And from a valuation perspective, while we are talking about high absolute valuations, the small caps in particular still look very favorable relative to their large cap peers. So with that, Joe, I'll turn it over to you to just jump into a couple of portfolio specific contributors for the quarter.
You're on mute, Joe.
All the time. I just wanted to point out a few of the things that have been working well and a few of the things that have been headwinds for us. On the contributor side, we've seen some particular strength in the consumer portion of the portfolio, with our top contributor being Every Holdings. They're one of the leading developers of slot machine titles, as well as providing fintech services to casinos worldwide. And they entered the pandemic as the hottest and fastest growing company on the slot machine side of the business and have reemerged from it even stronger. So you may see them with titles like Shark Week, The Vault, Hot Stuff, the old Casper, the friendly ghost character, and Joker's Wild in some casinos where they've been doing extremely well. And also on the fintech side, they're the largest provider of transaction processing solutions and compliance solutions. So as volumes have come back, so has their business. You'll also see Rapid7 in the cybersecurity space. That's been a big theme for us some time. And certainly the incidences of data breaches and hacker attacks on companies worldwide, but particularly in the US, as we've been away from our offices and our networks are stretched, that's been going up, putting those companies in even greater demand. And then I'd point to Dick's Sporting Goods and Yeti Holdings. With the rise in outdoor activities and outdoor living, they have done an exceptional job of capitalizing on that and have seen very strong revenue and earnings growth. I'll also talk about, as I mentioned, some of the headwinds. Some of the greater headwinds that we've seen have been in the healthcare space. And you see a number of healthcare and biotechnology related companies on this list. And one of the particular challenges that we've had there is that with the FDA, we're in a leadership transition that's there. And, you know, we believe that we've certainly been seeing a little less risk tolerance and a little more uncertainty among the investment community, particularly when you're in non-COVID related drugs and devices. That's heightened the volatility in the healthcare and specifically in the biotech space. We've also seen a number of biotech companies that have been challenged in getting patients to enroll in their clinical trials, given the fact that many people have been staying away from the doctor's offices and the hospitals unless they absolutely need to go there. And that sometimes leads to some compliance-related issues as well, making it even more challenging. to conduct those trials, and in some cases taking a lot longer to get those done than what would normally happen. The other thing you'll see here are a few companies like Churchill Downs, like Live Oak Bank Shares, BJ's Restaurants, who had been very strong performers through us for us earlier in the year, and we think just gave back a small portion of those gains with share declines, mostly in the 10 to 15% range, and still feel very comfortable with the fundamental outlook on those companies. So that's a quick snapshot there. Let me hand it back to Ken.
All right. And as you do that, Ken, this would be a good time to think about summating and wrapping up.
Okay. We will do that. I'll turn you to 26 for our top 10 portfolio holdings. Hopefully, from a board, you don't know too many of these companies. I think that's one of the things that, sets apart the small cap growth companies, is they don't have a lot of attention until they become, more household words and terms as they get bigger. A couple of these have been on our top 10 list for a while. Fresh Pet, which is a fresh refrigerated dog food, which has been the fastest growing aspect of animal meals. And this is the leading company in this space. So let me, on the sake of time, I think what's most important is a couple sheets on our market outlook. And one of the things that I will add, which is not on here, but I'll add this to Mitch's list of some of the positives that are out there, is that the capital markets are open. Obviously, companies, some small cap, but mostly the mid and the large cap companies, raising corporate debt, doing it at a very low cost, doing it at a very low spread. Is good for earnings on the market overall because it's lowering their cost of capital. And those, it's almost an insatiable demand for that product on the street for companies raising capital. They can do it several times. Some of our largest companies have done it several times just this year. The capital markets for equity offerings, which is a part of the small cap universe, for coming back to the market, raising more capital for growth opportunities that these companies see going forward. That marketplace is wide open, as we've seen a tremendous amount of secondary offerings as well as primary IPOs. So, Stacey, if you hit a couple aspects of the outlook.
Joe, if you would move to page 29 quickly. I think where we'll start, because I know this was a topic of discussion, just on the consumer backdrop, we have a pretty favorable outlook on the consumer. Acknowledge that the roll-off of some of those unemployment benefits could cause, some bump in spending, but we're hopeful that we're going to see an acceleration in employment as those unemployment benefits roll off. Anecdotally, in companies that have been speaking with, we have started to hear anecdotally of things start to loosen up. I have an associate of mine who runs a fitness franchise, and he had about 5 locations. And once those benefits rolled off, he had 14,000 applicants apply for about 10 positions in his 5 fitness locations. And I've heard similar anecdotal evidence of that as well from other national retailers that have been running job fairs and the like. So it does seem that that's starting to loosen up. So even if we do see a deceleration in the rate of growth, we do believe that there's enough there with net worth growth, wage expansion, et cetera, that we should see above trend growth continue into 2022, which I think aligns with the forecast. We're also optimistic, page 30, on the trajectory of business investment. We have not had a CapEx cycle in some time, but for a lot of reasons that were mentioned, I think Tim talked about the onshoring that's likely to take place here over the next couple of, you know, the next couple of years, well, next decades probably. As you think about that, we believe that's a catalyst. I think there's going to be additional investments in capacity and infrastructure, given all the supply chain bottlenecks. So we feel that there's a nice tailwind there at all and together, which collectively, again, should play into that above trend growth. Both from a small cap perspective on page 31, very nice correlation between small cap sales growth and CapEx. So to the degree that we see that recover, we do believe that small caps are going to be disproportionately benefited as a result of that. And I do think that you're starting to see that play out in the earnings forecast. So page 33, Ken and I both alluded to this earlier. The relative earnings growth that we're seeing out of small caps is extraordinary relative to the mid and large cap peers versus, I would say, the better part of the last decade. We have been in a small cap underperformance cycle. I think if you look at the annualized returns outside of the last year on the 3, 5, 7 year basis, small caps have lagged large caps, but we feel like we're on the verge of a small cap outperformance cycle driven by earnings. And I think, again, you can see this growth. We're looking at, you know, benchmark 21 versus 2019 base because of the volatility that was apparent in 2020, growth of 30%. I will tell you, since this report, we've seen further upward revisions, and that earnings growth rate is looking now about 40%. For 2021 versus 2019. And we've similarly seen that 2022 number move higher as well. And I think we're, you know, around the 20% mark in aggregate. And also notable for our style, why I had mentioned earlier that, you know, we were seeing a broad-based earnings recovery, which was really playing into kind of the cyclicals versus the secular stocks. That had a stronger earnings base and were able to, you know, maintain a stronger earnings base during the downturn, we do start to see the growth earnings start to outperform in 2022. And we do believe that that will end up putting a tailwind in particular, not just behind small caps, but will give some extra legs to growth given the recent underperformance that we've seen. And the last thing that I'll point to just very quickly on page 34 is that we've gotten those upward revisions to earnings while we've gotten a compression in multiples being applied to those earnings. So on a relative basis, when you look at the relative valuation of the Russell 2000 versus the Russell 1000, we're now in a better place today than we were earlier this year on an expanded earnings base. So for all of those reasons, we remain very favorable as to the outlook for small cap growth in particular. You know, we believe the U.S. innovation engine is alive and well, and there really is no better place to participate in that than through investment in the small cap growth area of the equity market.
And then just lastly, thank you very much for the addition to our portfolio in July. Appreciate the confidence that you have in Emerald. And we'll work every day as hard as we can to justify that confidence. So thank you very much.
Well, Ken, we're all counting on you. Thank you to you and Joe and Stacy for the presentation. Let's throw it out and make sure we've caught any questions or additional comments for Joe, Ken, or Stacy. Looking here on my view, am I missing anybody?
Yeah. Hey, Ken, I just wanted to ask about that performance. The performance noted was gross. Do you have any numbers on performance net of fees?
I do not. I believe we're in the 50 range on fees. So take off about 0.5%.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Ken, Joe, or Stacy? I'm not seeing any, so thank you all. Very interesting stuff. I would say, in a word, you remain bullish. So it sounds that way to me. Anyway. So thank you all. Appreciate the information. And until the next time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And again, thank you for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Goodbye.